Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers with New York Times bestselling authors Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. In this episode, Sherman and Wedge take you to the sandy beaches of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where a serial rapist is on the loose. But one of his victims is ready to turn the tables on her attacker. And now, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge.
It was a gray and blustery afternoon on April 4th, 2018, when Yarmouth, Massachusetts Police Chief Frank Fredrickson made his way back to Cape Cod from a law enforcement meeting in Boston. He was just settling into the tedium of the drive and the seemingly endless vista of pine trees along the Mid-Cape Highway as he neared the exit for Marston's Mills when an alert blared over his police radio. "Officer down! Officer down! Shots fired!" "Did I just hear that?" Fredrickson thought to himself. His mind immediately went to Corey, his son from his first marriage, who was a police officer in the town of Barnstable and a member of the Cape Cod Regional Law Enforcement SWAT team. The chief routinely monitored Barnstable's police frequency to check up on his son. But seconds later, the chief recognized the voices of Yarmouth police officers calling in over the radio. And that's when he knew. It wasn't his son, but it was one of his own. For a man who treats his officers like his extended family, it cut almost as close to home. As the information ricocheted across the radio, he learned the shooting victim was 32-year-old Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, a ruggedly handsome New Bedford native and a canine officer. He'd been struck in the head by a bullet as he entered the attic of a home in a quiet Cape Cod neighborhood while searching for a 29-year-old with a career criminal background wanted for a parole violation. Fredrickson fumbled for his cell phone and immediately called one of his commanders who was on the scene to get more information. "Sean was shot in the face," the officer told him. "We don't know how bad it is." Trying to pull himself together, the chief felt his heart and mind racing. "A gunshot wound to the face can mean many things," he told himself. "Sean may still be alive. He may be okay."
Fredrickson flipped on his siren and sped to a Cape Cod hospital. He pulled into the hospital parking lot with lights flashing and parked his cruiser outside the emergency room entrance. The scene was eerily quiet. Seconds later, he heard a loud noise and frantic activity as the ambulance carrying Gannon pulled up next to Fredrickson's vehicle. The doors of the ambulance flew open as a team of paramedics wheeled Gannon's stretcher into the ER. The chief ran alongside the gurney. Gannon's eyes were closed and his body was still. The officer's face was partially covered by a CPR machine. Fredrickson touched Gannon's boot and knew he was gone. The enormity of the tragedy hit him immediately. Fredrickson thought about Gannon and his family, especially his young wife, Dara, whom Gannon had just married 2 years earlier. Fredrickson thought about his own officers, the men and women of the Yarmouth Police Department, who would lean on him for support and look upon him for leadership. Compounding the heartbreak was the fact that Gannon's canine, Nero, a 2.5-year-old Belgian Malinois, was also shot in the face and neck and was now clinging to life. "It's all on me. I have to do this for everyone," Fredrickson whispered to himself. "There's nobody else." The chief wondered if he had the will to lead his people through this tragedy. He braced himself for what was ahead, the trauma everyone on his force would suffer. He knew he'd have to dig deep and revisit the pain of the first real test he ever faced as a police officer if he was to have any chance of helping the department through this dark time. His mind flashed back to the summer of '88.
Michelle Lynn and her three friends, Vicky, Chris, and Paul, had rented a small room for Memorial Day weekend at the Snug Harbor Motor Lodge in Yarmouth, Massachusetts. To Michelle, the Cape was paradise. She'd grown up in Rutland, Massachusetts on her family farm, but spent her childhood summers on the Cape. Now 23 years old, she still couldn't imagine a more appropriate way to kick off the summer of 1988 than spending the weekend there with her three close friends. The motel didn't look like much, and the room with its blood-colored shag rug was certainly nothing to write home about. but the location couldn't have been better. It was right in the middle of bar-hopping territory, with Guido Murphy's and Puffer Belly's just a couple of miles away in Hyannis. The Mill Hill Club and Rascals were also a short distance in the other direction along busy Route 28, the main tourist drag of motels, mini golf courses, ice cream shops, and kitschy souvenir shops that sold everything from rope bracelets to day glow tank tops. After a quick dinner on Saturday evening, the foursome drove into Hyannis to try Guido Murphy's nightclub. A long line snaked along the building as 20-somethings waited for the bouncers, all wearing Kelly Green polo shirts, to look over their IDs and let them inside. But when they made it to the head of the line and into the club, the music was thumping, and the air was scented with Dracar and Polo cologne. Most of the single men and even the not-so-single men took quick notice of Michelle, an attractive blonde who was sporting a pair of blue stonewashed jeans and a light blue sweater that hung low over one shoulder. But Michelle didn't feel like dancing with any of them.
Let's go to Puffer Belly's. It's supposed to be fun, and it's closer to the motel.
I'm not feeling too good. I think I'm just going to go back to the room, her friend Paul replied. I'll drop you guys off, though, and swing back to pick you up after last call. While Paul drove Michelle, Vicky, and Chris to Puffer Belly's, which was dark and cavernous and had several dance floors, making it very hard for the women to stay together. Michelle hadn't been drinking that night, and as she was getting tired, she tracked down Vicky and told her that she couldn't make it to last call. But Paul's going to come back to get us, the friend reminded Michelle.
Let's all walk back to the motel. It's not far from here. We'll flag down Paul if we pass him.
The women walked together across a dark parking lot and out onto the brightly lit street.
It was after 11 p.m., but Route 28 was as busy as ever, as throngs of young people were pouring out of the bars and heading back to their small motel rooms to party some more. They never saw Paul before making it back to the Snug Harbor. But when they got to their room, it was locked. They must have missed him going to pick them up.
I gave Paul the only key. I'll go to the front office and see if they have a spare.
She folded her arms and hugged herself against the cold evening air as she walked to the manager's office at the front of the motel. Michelle could hear laughter in the distance coming from rooms where after-hours parties were now in full swing. The light was on in the office, but when she walked in, she saw the small space was empty. As Michelle turned around to leave, she noticed a dark-haired young man with an average build just outside the door. He had his back toward her, and she could see the wispy plume of his cigarette floating in the night air above his head. The man turned.
In 2020, we interviewed Michelle about this ordeal. She was breaking her silence for the very first time. She tells us what happened next.
I said, I'll go up to the front desk and ask for a key. Because they had told us when we checked in, they made a big deal out of it, that there was 24-hour management and security at the hotel.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I went up to the front to get a key, and no one was in the office. And so I walked out of the office, and there was a guy standing there, and he was smoking a cigarette. And
so he's outside.
Outside of the office of the hotel. And he said, can I help you, or something like that. So I figured, he must be the manager. He's smoking. You know, he's out of the office because he's having a cigarette. So I said, I'm trying to get into my room. I need a key.
Yeah.
I can't get into my room. And he said, I can help you. And he grabbed me and, pulled me into the next hotel, had this wooded area, in front of it. And he grabbed me there. I was trying to get away. And
so when he grabbed you, what's going through your mind at the time?
Then I was like, this mustn't be the manager. And I was trying to get away.
Yeah.
And
how did you try to get away?
I was trying to kick him, and I was pulling away, and he was kind of dragging me, and then there was a big retaining wall there that we kind of had to climb over, but he threw me into that and hurt my hip really bad. I saw stars. It hurt.
She considered herself to be a strong girl thanks to the countless jugs of water she lugged from the house to the barn to feed livestock on the family farm. She'd even beaten all the boys at arm wrestling back in 8th grade, but she was no match for her attacker, who continued to drag Michelle toward a wooded area that divided the Snug Harbor from the motel next door. I want your underwear, the man said while grabbing between her legs. If you say anything, I'll kill you. I have a gun.
Michelle opened her mouth, trying to scream, but she wasn't sure any noise was coming out. The attacker slammed her head against the wall again, and her body went limp. She couldn't fight it any longer. But before she gave up completely, she had one last card to play. She tried to appeal to his humanity.
You don't have to do this. Are you having problems with your girlfriend? Please, please, this is not the way to solve them.
But the man wasn't listening. Instead, he dragged her deeper into the foliage and forced her pants down. Michelle had reached the moment when she realized there was nothing else that she could do. She knew that she would have to let herself be raped with the hope that her attacker would allow her to live. Right then and there, she made a vow to herself. I'm never going to tell anyone what happened. And for the next 10 minutes, in the wooded area just beyond the hotel, the man forced himself on her as she silently prayed. When he was done, she hoped that he'd just leave her there in the bushes, blurry-eyed and disheveled, with sticks and leaves in her matted hair. But the rapist had other ideas. I want to keep you, he told her. I want to take you to my room and do this all over again. He ordered Michelle to get dressed. She fumbled around in a daze, trying to pull on her sweater and jeans. Once again, she felt his hand on her arm. This time, the rapist was yanking her wrist, leading her out of the woods and into the bright streetlights of Route 28, just several yards ahead. As they reached the sidewalk and the dark-haired man started pulling her across the street, Michelle noticed a black Monte Carlo heading in their direction and knew this was her only chance. As the driver slowed down to let them cross, she flung herself onto the car's hood and screamed as loud as she could. The passenger, another 20-something, just leaving the bars, jumped out and reached for Michelle. But the rapist still had her in a death clutch. As the Good Samaritan pulled Michelle one way, her attacker pulled the other. She was caught in a desperate tug of war for survival. The driver of the Monte Carlo jumped out to help his friend, and the rapist finally let go and took off running back down the street toward Hyannis. Are you okay? One of the men asked. She didn't answer. All she could do was cry. We gotta go after that guy, the driver declared and spun the vehicle around.
No! Please, no. I just want to get out of here.
Hearing the sheer terror in the young woman's voice, the driver gave up the chase. Do you know where you are? He asked her. Where are you staying? Michelle pointed across the street at the Snug Harbor Motel, where her friends were now in the road calling out her name.
The two men escorted Michelle gently out of the back seat of their car and into Vicky's arms. You've been raped, haven't you? The friend whispered in Michelle's ear. She didn't answer. All she wanted was to climb into a hot shower and scrub the horror off her body. Paul returned to the room and stood guard by the bathroom door. He could hear her sobbing under the shower. You need to go to the hospital, Paul told her gently. You need to report this.
We can't let anyone ever know this happened.
It was the same mantra she'd been telling herself since the rapist slammed her body against the retaining wall, a defense mechanism and the only way she could control an episode that had so wholly stripped her of it. You'll help other people if you report it, Paul pleaded. This guy's going to do it again. That was all Michelle needed to hear to change her mind. Full of newfound resolve, she turned the shower nozzle off, wiped away her tears, and got dressed. Frank Fredrickson was 30 years old and a newly minted detective with the Yarmouth Police Department when the phone woke him up early Sunday morning on May 29, 1988. He was married with a child on the way, but he was also wed to his job. As the only officer in his department trained to investigate sexual assault cases, he received orders to meet Michelle at the station. The young woman looked like a walking crime scene. Despite taking a shower, Michelle still had some debris in her hair and a look of fear in her face that spoke to the horrific experience she had just endured. Oh my God, this is real, he thought to himself, and I have to investigate this case alone. The challenge and responsibility weighed heavily on the young detective.
And when I saw her sitting there, with this look and disheveled and stressed, peace, and you could see it was something not pleasant.
Hey, Casey, like our fans who tune in here on Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, we're all about truth. Working on our projects, I need a boost sometimes. I love my coffee, but I'm really loving these true lifestyle drinks.
Me too, Dave. There are 6 different flavors for every activity. They're gluten and GMO-free, organic, vegan, and there's no artificial sweeteners or additives. They're clean, and they contain all sorts of vitamins and nutrients, and they're damn tasty.
You know, True's founder, Jack McNamara, is a former pro hockey player, and he created True because he was looking for healthy energy drinks that wouldn't make you crash. I've been loving Energy, the Orange Mango Wake Up Blend, as well as Focus, the Apple Kiwi Brain Blend. Jack and his team have scientifically engineered some game-changing beverages, and I'm working several of them into my daily routine.
And I'm making them part of my lifestyle, too. True Drinks for true crime fans. Go to drinktrue.com and use the code SAINTS to get 30% off your purchase. Now, back to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. At first, Michelle didn't even want to talk to Fredrickson. She did not want to see or be near any man after her attack. She was completely freaked out. She kept asking for a female police officer, but the department didn't have one at the time. Michelle was stuck with Fredrickson. The young detective brought her into a cluttered small office and offered her a chair. Michelle's hip was badly bruised, and it was uncomfortable for her to sit in the chair opposite the detective. But she told him her story, her voice trembling throughout, while he diligently took notes. There were a series of images that were fresh in her mind. Her attacker smoking a cigarette with his back toward her, him grabbing her wrist, her body colliding with the retaining wall.
My watch slipped off my wrist while he was pulling me. He told me that he had a gun and that he'd kill me if I tried to run away.
Fredrickson was tall with fair hair, and though he was only 30 years old, he seemed older to her. He was calm and measured. He spoke softly, didn't judge her, and projected a quiet confidence. Michelle began to relax a little bit in his presence.
I don't have my underwear. They gotta be there, in the woods, where it happened.
After he took her statement, Fredrickson took Michelle to the hospital, where she was treated for her injuries. She was too traumatized to drive, so afterward, Vicky drove Michelle's car back to her parents' farm in Rutland, Massachusetts. They sat together in the long dirt driveway as Michelle took deep breaths and tried to compose herself to tell her parents. As she entered the house, her mom and dad were sitting around the kitchen with Michelle's younger sister and 2 younger brothers. Michelle stared blankly at them, unable to summon any words. "Oh God, what happened to you?" her mother asked. Michelle broke down crying. Her mother gently reached for her hand and guided her to the privacy of a bathroom where her daughter told her that she had just been raped hours before.
While shock, sadness, and anger filled Michelle's home in Rutland, Fredrickson began searching for evidence at the Snug Harbor Motor Lodge. The detective initially found Michelle's watch on the side of the road, but nothing else. Later that day, when the phone rang at Michelle's parents' house, her mother picked it up and passed it to her. It was the detective. Michelle felt comforted by Frank's voice on the other end of the line. "We found your watch," he told her, "but the band is broken. It must have happened while you struggled to break free."
"What about my underwear?"
"We didn't find it," he told her.
"What do you mean? It's gotta be there. It's gotta be there."
The notion that her undergarments were missing struck her like a sledgehammer to the chest. Michelle had been forced to take them off, she remembered. She could even remember which ones she was wearing, green with white polka dots purchased just the week before.
"Did my attacker take them as a souvenir?"
Michelle asked herself, caught somewhere between shock and revulsion at the thought of it. That night, she slept in her brother's bedroom with a knife under her pillow. Her brother stayed close by with a shotgun. It didn't matter that she was miles away from the scene of the crime. Just the knowledge that her attacker was still out there somewhere terrified her. Fredrickson delivered a general broadcast to all Cape Cod law enforcement with details of Michelle's attack and a description of the rapist. "I need to find this guy," Fredrickson told his colleagues. That was no easy task. It was 1988, There was no DNA analysis and no technology to share communications instantly far and wide. Police work was slow and arduous, and Fredrickson had to rely on his instincts. Meanwhile, as Fredrickson worked Michelle's case tirelessly, reports of more rapes on the Cape began coming in.
On June 10th, 1988, an intoxicated young woman climbed into a taxi on Main Street in Hyannis in front of a convenience store. As the driver pulled away from the curb, a man with dark hair emerged and flagged down the vehicle. "You can drop her off here," he said with a smile. "I'm her brother. I'll make sure she gets home safely." The man then opened the back door of the taxi and pulled her out. The cabbie continued down the street while the man dragged the drunken woman across the street to a wooded area and raped her. The victim was left bruised and dazed. 3 days later, on the evening of June 13th, a man approached a young blonde woman outside a motel, again on Main Street in Hyannis, just a few yards away from the previous attack. "Can you help move your car?" he asked her. She nodded, assuming that he worked there. As the woman fetched her keys from her purse, he grabbed her and dragged her into some nearby bushes. The woman let out a blood-curdling scream, but no one heard her. "Don't scream again," the rapist told her. "I have a gun, and I'll kill you." After pinning her down and mauling her on the ground, the attacker told her to get dressed before he disappeared into the night. A few weeks later, on August 6th, a young woman walked alone on Scudder Avenue in Hyannisport, just a stone's throw away from the Kennedy compound. She heard footsteps following close behind her and picked up the pace, when suddenly she felt a man's arm wrap around her neck and jerk her backwards to the ground. The attacker kept her in a tight chokehold and demanded that she take off all of her clothes. He pulled her into the bushes, sexually assaulted her, and bit her breast. When Frank Fredrickson shared the details of his case with investigators from the Barnstable Police Department, they told him about a string of sexual assaults that were happening with frightening frequency in the Hyannis area. There was one common denominator in all of them. All of the victims were missing their underwear. The detective now knew that Michelle's attack was no isolated incident. Cape Cod had a serial rapist on the loose.
Michelle returned to the Cape days later, accompanied by her father, George, a big, rugged John Wayne type who was now demanding justice for his daughter. "You'd better get this guy," the father told Fredrickson. The young detective had Michelle sit with a sketch artist while trying to describe her attacker. She remembered his body and mannerisms, but blanked on a rapist's face. The end result was a composite sketch that looked like a young Tom Brady. Meanwhile, Fredrickson thought he got a break in the case when a witness identified a man running down Route 28 toward Hyannis on the night that Michelle was attacked. This guy had a criminal record, but a search warrant of his home turned up empty. When Fredrickson showed his photo, along with a series of mugshots, to Michelle for examination, she pointed to the suspect.
"It's definitely not that guy."
Fredrickson was deflated. He had felt that he was close to solving the case, the biggest of his career so far, but Michelle was adamant that the man was not her attacker. Still, it served as a valuable lesson for the young detective, teaching him not to be too hyper-focused on one thing, because that can throw even the best detective off the real thing. He also learned to listen to the victim. "Michelle taught me to see the case through her eyes," he said. As the two worked together, she continued to describe how strong her attacker was. "Does this mean he works out?" Fredrickson asked himself. "Does he work with his hands?" He continued to rummage through boxes of police photos at other departments on the Cape, but didn't make any progress. "We're not going to find him here in boxes of black and white photos," Fredrickson thought in frustration. "We need to catch him on his own hunting ground." The detective convinced Michelle to return to the Cape one more time and canvass the nightclubs.
"He's going to strike again and again," Fredrickson told her. "I trust you when you say that you'll know it's him when you see him again. I'm counting on that." Normally, a rape victim would only be called upon to identify his or her attacker from a physical lineup or a group of photos. Fredrickson was enlisting Michelle to join him on the front lines of the investigation, in the center of the hunt. For a frightened young woman who originally wanted no one to know what happened to her, Michelle had become a determined participant in the quest to find her attacker. Thoughts of him were so all-consuming that she found herself unable to focus on work. She was obsessed with finding him. That made two of them. As the summer wore on, Fredrickson only grew more desperate to catch the rapist, so he wouldn't slip through his net after all the local bars closed for the season. Fredrickson gave Michelle a pep talk before she entered the crowded Mill Hill Club with an undercover officer by her side. Hearing the music and the laughter, she was immediately transported back to that fateful weekend in May. She recognized the few friends who approached her to make some small talk while she scanned the crowded bar. Michelle whispered to the police officer that one man looked frighteningly familiar to her. The officer quietly approached the dark-haired man, took him outside, and questioned him for several minutes. He wasn't the guy, and Michelle felt sick to her stomach that she had nearly accused the wrong person. Fredrickson asked her to give it one more try. He told her that this time he would be accompanying her and make sure that she was safe.
"I will be with you the whole time," he told Michelle. "If you spot him, we'll have him surrounded quickly." They took their search into Hyannis, where at least three of the attacks had occurred in the previous weeks. They were joined by two investigators from Barnstable who fanned out and patrolled the east end of Main Street, while Fredrickson and Michelle took the west end and the area's most popular spot, Guido Murphy's. The detective concealed his police radio and they posed as a couple as they entered the bar. Together, they moved from between rooms where people were dancing and drinking beer and cocktails. Michelle looked closely at the faces of every man they passed but recognized no one, so they left the bar and stood across the street. Michelle felt frustrated but determined.
"I'll know him when I see him."
Fredrickson nodded in agreement while trying to stand inconspicuously outside the bar. He knew that maybe the trick wasn't to track his suspect, but to wait patiently, like a deer hunter, for the suspect to come to him. Moments later, he looked at Michelle and saw that something wasn't right. She was shaking and looked like she was hyperventilating. Frank immediately recognized the signs of trauma. Michelle stared straight ahead toward a man who had just emerged from the bar. He had his back toward them and he was smoking.
"That's him! I know that's him!"
"It doesn't look like him," the detective observed, referring to the composite sketch. "Are you sure?" Michelle didn't waver.
"I'm positive."
As the suspect began walking east onto the center of Main Street, the detective radioed his counterparts at Barnstable Police. "We've identified the suspect, and he's coming your way." Fredrickson and Michelle followed the man, making sure they stayed a few paces behind. They watched as a couple of teenagers approached the man outside a liquor store. The man slipped inside, bought a six-pack for the teenagers, and returned to his car, a gold Cadillac that was parked in the alleyway behind the store. The detectives from Barnstable caught up with Fredrickson, and they watched the man approach the vehicle. "One of the victims mentioned a gold Cadillac," one of the investigators said. "Bingo," Fredrickson thought. They approached the suspect while Michelle stayed behind. "We'd like to ask you a few questions," one of the detectives said. The man appeared calm. He thought he'd just been caught buying beer for minors. It was a hassle for sure, but nothing major. "Can you come to the station with us?" the detective continued. "Shouldn't take long. You can even drive your own car." The suspect agreed and drove to the Barnstable police station. The detectives led the way, with Fredrickson and Michelle following close behind. The man parked the gold Cadillac and walked breezily into the station. Before being questioned, the man was allowed to use the telephone. He called his father, who lived in East Falmouth, Massachusetts. "I'm getting questioned," the suspect said. "No, it's not about rape." The man's name was John Flower, and he was 27 years old. What Fredrickson did not know at the time was that Flower, who worked as a laborer for a local building supply company, was under indictment for a 1987 sexual assault outside of a nightclub in Falmouth. In that case, he grabbed a woman outside, carried her down the street to a wooded area, where he threw the victim down and pulled her clothes off.
Flower was taken into the interrogation room where he waited to be interviewed. Seconds later, Michelle walked past the room escorted by a detective. She stared into the rapist's eyes and he stared back. Suddenly, the suspect's calm demeanor eroded and he began to sweat and look antsy. As Michelle was led to another room where she was asked to identify Flowers' photo, Fredrickson tried to keep the suspect engaged in small talk. Flower was not charged yet with the crime, so the detective needed to work to keep the conversation light. "What do you do for work?" he asked Flower. "When can I get out of here?" the man replied, avoiding the question. "How's your summer been so far?" Fredrickson continued in a calm tone. "I need to get out of here," Flower shot back. At that moment, Flower reached under the table and found a button to open the door of the interrogation room. He jumped to his feet and ran out the door. Fredrickson leapt from the table and chased after him, with other officers following close behind. Flower pushed his way through the station, out to the parking lot, and jumped into his car. Two cops were able to use their cruisers to block his escape route. Surrounded by Fredrickson and the other officers, all with their guns drawn, John Flower surrendered without a fight. The next day, a search warrant was executed on the home he shared with his father at 23 Portside Drive in East Falmouth. Officers entered his bedroom, searched his drawers, and turned over his bed. Underneath the mattress, they discovered several pairs of women's underwear, among them a green pair with white polka dots.
I think I thought once he was caught, I'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, but it definitely didn't work out that way. Yeah.
Fredrickson made sure he was inside the courtroom when Michelle read her victim impact statement. He felt like he had to be there for her, and he knew that without Michelle's courageous decision to come forward and become actively involved in the hunt for the rapist, Flower would remain free to attack again.
"I don't think I'll ever regain the self-confidence and carefree attitude,"
Michelle said aloud in court.
"I now suspect every stranger I see with wanting to hurt me. To this day, I sleep with a knife under my mattress. I spent many hours in therapy trying to get over these fears, but somehow, I think they will always be with me."
John Flower ultimately pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 20 years behind bars at the Sexually Dangerous Treatment Center at Bridgewater State Hospital. Through years of therapy, Michelle learned to trust again. She got married and eventually had two kids, but she never forgot Frank Fredrickson. As her victim's advocate, Fredrickson occasionally reached out to her to inform her about Flower's parole hearings. But the two also stayed in touch on a personal level, even exchanging Christmas cards. Long after they stopped discussing the events of that horrible night in 1988, they still had things to talk about. By the early 2000s, both divorced, they began talking on the phone about the challenges of co-parenting, as both had two kids with former spouses. Michelle, who was living in Boylston, Massachusetts at the time, felt that she could trust Frank, just as she had done during that terrifying summer on Cape Cod 30 years before.
Frank and Michelle decided to meet for lunch one day. Neither went looking for romance. Michelle had not seen him for several years and only remembered that he was much older than she was. But if 7 years is a lot when you're 23, it isn't so much when you're in your 40s. When they saw each other at the restaurant, it wasn't just her view of their age difference that shifted, but the lens through which she looked at him. She no longer saw him as merely her victim's advocate. She began to see him as a man who was placed in her life for a reason. She saw him as her soulmate. They began dating, fell in love, and 2 years later they were married on Cape Cod.
Like, people ask me all the time, how did you meet your husband? And it, not realizing it's like
it is a
yeah. story. It's
yeah.
not, you know.
Yeah.
They all think it's because I got arrested or something.
As Frank had instilled confidence in Michelle during their hunt for John Flower, she provided equal support for Frank's career. When he interviewed for the top job at the Yarmouth Police Department, Fredrickson felt it was a long shot. "I'm not police chief material," he confided to her. "I hate speaking in public." Michelle understood more than anyone what a leader her husband truly was. Her confidence in him wasn't born from the idea that she was his loving wife. It grew from the fact that she had been a victim of a case that he labored over virtually alone and eventually solved by believing in and trusting her. Without Frank's calm demeanor and care for her as a victim of a terrible violent attack, she may have never come forward, and that would have meant more women would have gotten hurt by John Flower. Michelle knew that if ever there came a day that tested her husband's mettle, he'd answer the call just like he had done following the attack at the Snug Harbor Motel 30 years ago. That day came when he got the call, "Officer down."
On April 14th, 2018, thousands of Cape Cod residents and police officers from across New England gathered at a vigil to remember Sergeant Sean Gannon, whose murder had shaken the community and the department to its core. Michelle was there, handing out balloons and candles with the wives of other Yarmouth police officers, while Fredrickson, now police chief, took to the podium and offered words of comfort to the fallen officer's family.
Mr. and Mrs. Gannon, your son was remarkable, a result of what you produced. The people he touched and made their lives better, it's endless. They will continue to pop up as time goes on, and how they were positively impacted by Sean. Please be extremely proud. In his short life, he made so many people better. So thank you for what you did by raising this wonderful child. As I continued to search with my answers, it continued to come to me in thinking, I have a plan. I know what Sean did and how his life has saved somebody else, because that disgusting person was going to hurt or kill somebody else. And Sean stopped that from happening. It's hard to measure what we prevent, but I can guarantee you, Sean saved somebody's life.
Those words weren't hollow. In the aftermath of the tragedy, Fredrickson immediately ensured that all officers in the department had peer supporters to help them process the trauma, and that they got as much time as they needed to do so. Not all police chiefs are as sensitive to the need for mental health support or the ways that trauma can affect people, not just in the days, but years and even decades after the event.
Since Gannon's death, Fredrickson has used this understanding of trauma to make an impact beyond Yarmouth. He's called on other police departments to offer peer counseling to first responders recovering from witnessing ordeals like the standoff that led to Sergeant Sean Gannon's murder. He's also lobbied for passage of a long-stalled bill that protects the privacy of first responders when seeking mental health treatment. It was signed into law by Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker in 2019.
Last year, Chief Fredrickson was also given an award by the Massachusetts Association of Police for his leadership in the aftermath of Gannon's death. When he thanked his wife Michelle for her support and admitted that such an honor would be impossible without her, only the two of them knew what he really meant. Serial rapist John Flower died in 2020 of natural causes. And Michelle told us that she can finally breathe again.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. This episode is brought to you with thanks to our sponsor, Work Local in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Special thanks to actress Alyssa Lynn for performing the role of her mother, Michelle Lynn. Music in this episode was provided by Chris Spagone. You can reach Chris on Instagram at ChrisElaniusArt. For more on the Mudhouse Media Podcast Network, visit MudhouseMedia.com. That's Mudhouse with two Ds. And for the latest updates on their podcast and all of the writing and film projects of Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, please visit FortPointMedia.com.